Welcome to Great Australian Lives.
For Tobin Brothers Funerals,
celebrating lives. Here's your host, Laura Turner.
Hello and welcome to another special edition of Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. I'm Laura Turner. Well, tonight's guest is a radio icon, a stalwart of the industry who's documented, discussed and debated some of the biggest issues of our time. He's been instrumental to the success of some of Australia's most prominent radio shows, not just because of his special connection with his audience, but also his fearlessness in voicing his opinion. It is my great pleasure to welcome Steve Price to Great Australian Lives. How are you, Steve?
Great, Laura. Thanks for having us on.
Yeah, it's an absolute pleasure. Right now, where is life at for you? Things have changed in recent times. What are you doing at the moment?
I guess like the rest of the world, I'm dipping my toe into the great podcast pool, which seems to be very crowded at the moment. So I'm not sure how good that's going to end up being. But I've launched a series of podcasts called On the Record, and I've already chatted with some of the more interesting names in Australia. I started with my old mate Sam Newman, who's been in the news of recent times. I had a great chat to him. He and I worked together for a long time, me as his boss, and then he as a colleague of mine. I've also had a wonderful chat with Kerri-Ann Kennelly, who I think is a legend and an icon in Australia. She's a living legend, a treasure of Australians. She's just been around for so many years doing so many successful things. And tragically, of course, she lost her husband after that awful accident where he became a quadriplegic, and she talks in very tender terms about him. I've spoken to so many people. It's fun. It's enjoyable to do. It's a passion project, and it's nice to have the time to do it.
Yeah, and it is good at the moment. The silver lining of COVID, I guess, is having a little bit of extra time to do things like this. I want to know, Steve, you've just mentioned two people in Sam Newman and Kerri-Ann too on, I guess, a lesser level who have been, I guess, controversial at times in commentary in Australia. Putting you three in a room together, you're all outspoken. Do you end up, you know, in heated debates yourselves?
If you put the three of us in a room together and compared our attitudes to issues and topics and Australia and the world, we would come up with different views on what we think, I imagine. We're all of a similar generation, although I'm not quite as old as Sam. I won't even talk about how old Kerri-Ann is. She'd kill me. So we'll leave that out of it. But I think the commonality between all of us is that we are passionate about issues, and we're not afraid to voice them. Now, I mean, that has caused bigger troubles for Sam Newman than it has for me, because I don't think Sam, and he won't mind me saying this, I don't think Sam has the media filter on what he says. I mean, Sam Newman grew up as a star kid footballer out of a very, you know, upmarket private school. And so he doesn't have that training. I'm a journalist after all. Sam is a footballer. Kerri-Ann grew up as in Brisbane. And she was in showbiz before she became what she now is, a social commentator on Studio 10. But Kerri-Ann, I think, has more of a filter than Sam. And then there's me, who knows through Laura really, brutal experiences in the past, that you have to be careful about things like libeling somebody, defamation, shredding someone's reputation unnecessarily. If you've got the facts and you want to criticize someone, fine, that's not a problem. But when you start as a journalist, as I did at age 17, and had that old school training, you do tend to have more of a filter. It doesn't mean I've managed over 48 years in the media not to get myself into trouble, but you are a bit more careful.
Yeah, and it's interesting at the moment, things we seem to be having to be more careful, certainly. People talk about the age of political correctness and that sort of thing, and you having been around for so long, you would have seen the landscape change drastically.
Yeah, well, there's great talk about the fact that the Australian larrikin has disappeared from our media, and that's probably the case. I mean, you know, I can almost, I'm not quite that old, but I can almost remember Graham Kennedy and Bert Newton and the stuff that they got away with on television live on the great In Melbourne Tonight programs of the 60s, and some of the comedians that we've had in Australia, some of the song lyrics that have been written in Australia, you would not get away with that sort of discussion these days. We have been we have taught ourselves to be more respectful to both sides of the sexes, of Indigenous Australians, and I think that's all a great thing. Have we lost our sense of humour? Well, I interviewed Peter Hellyer, my colleague on the project from Channel 10 the other day, and one question I asked Peter was, how do you actually put a comedy act together now? I mean, it must be extremely difficult. And he said, it's harder now than it's ever been because you almost are treading on eggshells. So I think, Laura, what successful people in the media do is they have a good filter. They still are prepared to have an honest, strong, straight opinion and stand by it. What I can't stand is people who flip and flop. I mean, no one will ever die wondering what I stand for on certain issues. And people have said, oh, you're a conservative, you're a right-wing nut job. Well, I mean, seriously, you know, I can remember having a massive argument live on air on 3AW with the then Immigration Minister, Peter Reith, about boat people, and everybody will remember that awful vision of children supposedly being thrown into the ocean off the north coast of Australia as the Navy intercepted a people smuggling vessel. And I simply said to Peter Reith, and I remember that this to this day, I said, Minister, look, you're a father, I'm a father. I don't believe that a parent would throw a toddler into the ocean for whatever reason. I will never believe that story. And as it turned out, of course, what happened was the boat was sinking. People jumped overboard with their children in their arms. I mean, they weren't throwing kids into the water at all. John Howard and Peter Reith had been misled, and history teaches us that I was probably right. The moral, if you put a moral judgment against an act, you often find that you've got to, you know, some people go over the top without checking the facts. I think that's a silly thing to do.
Yeah. I interviewed very recently Peter Fitzsimons on this show, someone who's also very outspoken and not everyone agrees with his opinions on things, and that's their right. But I think I had the same discussion with him. I love someone with an opinion, whether you agree with them or not. I can't stand fence sitters. At the moment, it's more important than ever that we do share our opinions, even though it's probably more difficult to do so. Would you agree with that?
Yes, everybody has a right to express an opinion. And if you look at, particularly on radio, if you look at the programs that have been and are successful, they are most normally anchored by someone with a background of strong opinion. And you can trace that opinion all the way back and see that they haven't suddenly gone one way or another just to become either successful or to rate. I mean, I think the Australian public are very good at seeing through frauds, whether it be a politician or a media performer. They know if somebody's expressing an opinion they don't genuinely feel, you can hear it almost. And, you know, I did daily radio from about, got to go back and work it out now, but from 96 to 2019. And the audience will immediately pick you up if you say, have a strong opinion about something that is completely opposite to what you said 5 years ago. You'll think no one would ever remember, but they do. And you know, that's why you have to honestly express a view about something, not do it just for the sake of getting a headline or do it for the sake of getting a cheap ratings point. It's, if you're not expressing honestly your view about things, then I think you'll get found out very quickly. No, probably the best example of that in terms of longevity and success would be Alan Jones. I mean, you might not have liked, and I certainly had my disagreements with things that he has said, but you can't question ever that his opinions were heartfelt and that he expressed them with a passion because he really had either had the lived experience or he knew by correspondence with him and doing his radio program how people felt about things. And so, you know, I disagreed completely with his view on things like coal seam gas, but Alan went on and on and on about it. And in the end, it was proven in many areas that he was right. So you've got to have honest opinions and not flip and flop. If you do, you'll get found out very quickly.
Yeah, and I think that's part of your longevity. You are someone, you're not a flip-flopper. You have strong opinions. I think I was watching or researching some of yours last night, AFLW. Your opinions on that were very strong on one side in the beginning, and it was your daughter who actually changed your mind in the end, wasn't it? But you very honestly came forth and said, yep, I've changed my opinion.
Yeah, she had me in tears after that. I mean, I was of the view that you know, I looked at it the wrong way. I looked at it from a business and male point of view, that, and I expressed the view that I didn't think people would cross the road to go and watch AFLW, and that if you were charging an entry fee, you'd have very small crowds and interest would quickly fall away. I got a text message from my daughter Lucy who said, "You've really upset me. I'm in tears. You, as a father, taught me to love AFL. She's a Richmond fan like me. And because of AFLW spreading down the ranks, I finally got my chance to play the game that I loved watching. And your views that you don't rate it really cut to the heart. And I got upset about it." And so, I went back on air the next night and said, "Look, I've had this response, and I've got to look at this game from a different point of view now, because my daughter has straightened me up and said, 'Come on, Dad, give us a go. We want to play because we love the game.'" And she's absolutely correct. Would I still go and watch a game? Probably not, unless she was playing in it. If she was playing in it, I'd love to go and watch it. But, yep, she straightened me up, and it's great that I've managed to raise a young woman who can say to her father, "Wake up, Dad."
That's the beauty of having you as a dad, I guess. It must be humbling when you, you have quite a reach in Australia and a dominant voice on the scene of commentary, to have your good old daughter sending a text message to sort of make you go, "Oh, hang on a second."
Yeah, look, I think the best commentators around the country have a real and proper lived-in experience, and being a father, obviously, it allows you to have a viewpoint about how younger Australians are coping. I mean, the audience for the project on 10 is younger than what my radio audience traditionally has been, and working with people like Carrie Bickmore and Waleed Ali and Pete Hellier means that often the conversations we're having are about issues that affect people perhaps aged between, 18 and 30. Now, someone like me, who's now 65 years old, obviously, clearly, I'm not as impacted by what's going on around the country as those young people to have an informed opinion. But if you talk to your children, then clearly you are. I mean, one of the biggest issues I think we have in the country at the moment is, luckily for someone like me, I'm at the back end of my working career, as opposed to someone who's just starting out. And COVID has put another layer on top of what was already a difficult employment situation for young Australians. There's not enough jobs, youth unemployment's too high, and now with the COVID settling in across people, I mean, that daughter of mine, Lucy, that I mentioned earlier, I mean, she has just finished a 5-year law degree at ANU. Now, is she ever going to get a job? I mean, she doesn't know, and, law firms are laying people off. They're not hiring people because of the fact that their businesses have been hit by this dreadful COVID-19 dilemma that we've got around the world. So it's good to, I guess what I'm saying in short, Laura, is it's good to have younger people you can turn to for information when you're talking about issues that affect younger Australians.
Yeah, just on employment, you departed Nine Radio late last year. At that time, you said you were not surprised, maybe a bit annoyed, but the world is your oyster now. Have you found that to be the case? You've got your podcast happening. I'm sure other doors have been opening up to you.
Oh, there's so much that is available to do. It's just a matter of I'm trying to work out how I ever had time to work full time. I mean, I was very happy doing a prime shift on 2GB and 4BC and 2CC in Canberra, but Nine Radio wanted to go in a different direction. That's their option. That's all fine. They asked me if I'd go back and host the night program nationally, and I'd done that for 8 years, and I'm not the sort of person that really likes to go back in the other direction. So we parted ways very amicably. There's been no drama between me and them, and I wish everybody who's doing any job on radio all the success that they can have. It's a privilege to have a slot, prime time on Talkback Radio. I've always said there's probably only 8 or 10 jobs in Australian media on Talkback Radio that are available. If you've got one, you should treasure it. And I've done every shift from breakfast to nights and everything in between, including mornings, afternoons and drives. So there's not too many people who've done all of the major shifts, and I've done that, and I've had a great time doing it. I still miss the biggest thing that I miss not doing it on a daily basis is I don't miss getting up at 3:15 in the morning to do breakfast. I don't miss covering some of the more gruesome disasters that have happened around the country and around the world. What I do miss is the daily interaction with talkback callers, because radio is the great town hall meeting that you can have, because everybody's got a radio in their car, Everybody's got a radio signal now on their phone, and people want to ring you and tell you what is important. And so that grounds you and gives you a greater, I think, understanding of what Australians are really thinking. I mean, you can sit in a newspaper office and write a stinging editorial in a tabloid newspaper, but you haven't been speaking to your customers, the readers, the people who actually buy your paper. But with radio in particular, you are getting instant feedback, and that's what I so much loved about the medium of talkback radio. I think it's absolutely unbelievable. And you know, the years that I spent at 3RW were some of the happiest years of my life. Likewise, in the latter years with Nine Radio and in the middle, Southern Cross. It's been great.
Yeah, what an honour that must have been. This is Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. In these challenging times, Tobin Brothers offer a range of very practical solutions to help you plan a funeral and pay tribute to your loved one. For more information, visit tobinbrothers.com.au and more with the iconic Steve Price in just a moment.
You're listening to Great Australian Lives with Laura Turner for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
Welcome back to Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. Tobin Brothers now offer fully live streamed services so that anyone who cannot attend the funeral of a loved one can still view the service and participate. For more information, visit tobinbrothers.com.au. Our guest tonight on Great Australian Lives is broadcaster and journalist Steve Price. Now, Steve, we've talked all about your career and where you're at now, but I want to rewind a little bit. Your early years, were you born... I've read conflicting things. Were you born in Adelaide or Melbourne?
South Australian, born and bred in 1955. And the hospital I was born in actually overlooked what used to be the Formula One racing circuit in South Australia when Adelaide still had the F1 races before the dirty Victorians went and stole it.
That would have been a good view for anyone getting treatment or having a baby around the long weekend.
Bit noisy.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, you, as we know, you're someone who, you know, you share your opinion and you love to have a debate. Are you someone who, because you grew up in South Australia, are very defensive? Some people, you know, like to have a crack at South Australians. Do you stand up for them?
I tended not to because, I mean, parochialism, I don't think suits anybody. I mean, I know so many South Australians who, for whatever reason, decided that they needed to get out of Adelaide and go and work in places like Melbourne and Sydney. And if you look through the media landscape of Australia, you don't have to look too far and too hard to find a successful South Australian. They're dotted around everywhere. I mean, I was lucky enough to be posted out of Adelaide to Melbourne for 12 months as a very young reporter to be the Victorian correspondent back to the newspaper that I worked on in Adelaide. So I did that for 12 months. And what that does is it really, Laura, opens your eyes and shows you that there's a much bigger world out there. I mean, crazily, when I did that, I was 18 years old. I'd never been on a plane, so I flew to Melbourne. They put me up in a fairly dodgy hotel in the middle of the city and then said, you got a week's accommodation paid for you, then you can find yourself somewhere to live. So they were incredible times to actually go to then what was an afternoon and morning newspaper giant in the Melbourne, the Sun News Pictorial and the Melbourne Herald, to work in a building like that with so many talented people and report back to South Australia was a great privilege. And it just opened my eyes that there was so much more in Australia that you could achieve by perhaps not staying parochial and staying in Adelaide. That being said, you know, when people bag South Australia as, you know, the child-snatching capital of the world and the fact that, you know, it's dull and boring and hot. And I mean, there's so many good things about South Australia. And I think with the COVID border lockdown, I mean, you know, none of us have been able to go to the wonderful Barossa Valley or to McLaren Vale to drink those beautiful wines that South Australia makes. It's Kangaroo Island got wiped out by the bushfires, as you know, Laura, at the end of last year. Half the island completely destroyed. Yeah. That had become a tourist mecca where you could go and experience some great South Australian hospitality. So when people say, oh, you're from Melbourne, aren't you? I say, no, I'm from Adelaide. But really, I've managed to work full-time in South Australia, Victoria and New South Wales. And I've enjoyed living in all of those cities. And people often say to me, well, what do you prefer, Sydney or Melbourne? I say, well, I like them both, and I like them both for different reasons. And you know, I can go on about what those different reasons are, but there's great things about Sydney and there are great things about Melbourne. And there are equally great things about South Australia and Adelaide as well.
Yeah, I'd absolutely have to agree with that. They all have some amazing attributes to them. As being a born and bred Adelaide boy, do you have memories, of your childhood of visiting those places like the Barossa Valley? Did your parents take you on family holidays? What was life like in the 50s and 60s as young Steve? Were you Steve? Were you Stephen? What was childhood like?
Stephen, for sure, with a PH, and I was never Steve. Even my first bylines in the Adelaide News were always Stephen with a PH. Our family holidays were very basic, but we had a great life. I grew up south of the city. I was a bike ride away from the beach. We would go on family caravan holidays to places that are now just outer suburbs of Adelaide. I can remember, we thought it was extraordinary that we would drive to the Victorian border and you could stand on the border with one foot on either side of Victoria and South Australia and have your picture taken. We thought that was the bee's knees. We thought that was the best holiday you could possibly have. We used to go up to the Riverland, places like Renmark, Berry and stuff like that. I mean, so I was born in 55. So, the holidays that I remember, so probably from the age of 8 or 10, so from, 63, 4 through to the end of the 60s, Australian families didn't get on a plane and fly to the Gold Coast. I mean, if you went to the Gold Coast as a family in those times, you drove there. You were jammed into the back of a Holden station wagon. My dad sold Holden, so we always had a pretty good car. But you're in the back of a Holden station wagon, no air conditioning, yeah. Windows down, driving, across the Hay Plain for 7 hours where it's 43 degrees. That's how you got to the Gold Coast.
You've probably got no seatbelt on, jammed into the boot with your siblings. My mum tells really similar stories.
Seatbelts? No way. The dog was flying around the back of the car. I mean, it was when you think back on it, it's probably tortuous, but it was an innocent time and everybody had so much fun. And the fact that, to think that you would go on an overseas holiday, even somewhere as close as Bali, was completely beyond comprehension. I mean, back then, didn't even know where Bali was. Bali didn't exist as an Australian holiday destination. And so I think the Great Australian Road Trip has always been something instilled in me. I for many years with my two children, would insist that we do pre-Christmas every year a road trip somewhere, whether it be northern New South Wales or whether it be the Great Ocean Road or further up into Queensland. I just still love doing a road trip. I don't know what it is. It's maybe something you grow up with it and you absolutely enjoy it.
Yeah, I have to agree with you. It's great to explore your own backyard, and we have a beautiful one here in Australia. You've said your mum in different interviews that your mum was a classic 60s housewife. She sort of cooked the old CWA type meals. She loved a mean roast. Is that where you got your passion for food from, mum, or was it somewhere else?
Yeah, probably. The old man was a typical father of that generation, where the only cooking he did was on a barbecue, and it was powered by bits of wood, not by a gas bottle, by the way. He would never let anyone else touch the barbecue, but that was it. You take him inside the house, stand him in front of a stove, and he'd look at you blankly and say, "What do you expect me to do now?" And so I think watching my mother provide food 7 days a week. Oh, no, I should say, Laura, 6 days a week, because on Saturday night, the old man would go for his afternoon session at the pub down the road, no RBT in those days, have a session of drinking beers with his mates. He would then cross the road. This is the Flagstaff Hotel, and he would go across the road on South Road to a fish and chip shop, and he would bring home hot chips and a steak sandwich with onion. But this fish shop, I can still taste it, did better than anyone else in the world ever. And that would be Saturday night's dinner. And so we had takeaway once a week, and that's what it was, chips and a steak sandwich. Occasionally you might get, if you're lucky, a fried dim sim. That was like heaven. Saturday night we would wait for that meal. But 6 times a week, your mother would cook dinner. And she wasn't at work. I mean, she chose to stay home and be there when her children got back from school, and that's what she chose to do. And she did it extremely well, and her range of cooking wasn't something that you'd see today on MasterChef, but it certainly taught me the basics. And so when I moved out of home at an early age and into the invariable share house with blokes who had no idea on how to cook anything, I took over the mantle of cooking. And I'll tell you the secret as to why I like to cook. It's because if you're in charge of cooking, you're in charge of what you're eating, and that means that you can choose what the dish is going to be rather than have someone else cook it. and you have to eat it and you don't like it.
And you've been, I've heard you talk about that too in terms of being in charge of what you're eating. It's well documented how much you love to cook and you've even, been on TV doing so and winning so. But you've talked about not being someone who orders, Uber Eats or Deliveroo, those sorts of things, because, well, it's lazy and in your words, supporting an industry that you don't necessarily agree with in terms of those, lowly paid delivery drivers. Do you still stand by that?
Yeah, I think it's morally corrupt what those poor blokes and girls are forced to do for minimum income of $8-$10 an hour. I mean, you see it in whether you're in Sydney or whether you're in Melbourne, winter's night, it's dark, it's raining, you've got these poor buggers on underpowered motor scooters, probably with little idea on how to ride them, delivering food in a backpack for people who are too lazy to get off their backsides and go out and either eat out or go and pick it up themselves. And I refuse to endorse or have anything to do with those food delivery companies, because I think they're doing great social fabric damage to Australian life, where it was always for Australians, you would go out, whether it be to the pub to have a fairly simple counter dinner or counter lunch, or you go out and go into your local little Italian restaurant and have a bowl of pasta, or you go and pick up your pizza yourself. I just don't get why people think it's better to sit home, on the couch, glued to the TV, and have some poor bugger who's been paid no money to risk their lives to deliver your dinner at home. I just shake my head. Maybe in this regard, and I consider myself a reasonably modern person, in this regard, I find myself having old-fashioned views, and maybe we all get to a certain age where we start to have those cranky old-fashioned views, but I just don't get it.
Yeah, that's fair enough. Speaking of old-fashioned, you, I shouldn't say old-fashioned, that's probably condescending to say, but you were in the heydays of the 80s working with people like John Laws. People have talked about those as the glory days, where there were long, boozy lunches and certainly a different time. Do you look back on those times, with a sense, I guess, of honour of being part of that?
Yeah, look, I took over from Lawsy when he retired, and so I know what an iconic program that was that he did. I mean, it was on 60-odd stations right around the country, all the way from, Cairns in the north to down to southern New South Wales. So, look, John Laws, who can forget the intro to his program, and John would come on and say, "Hello, world," which was just a listening point for people, particularly in New South Wales and Queensland. And Lawsy loved to think about him is he always enjoyed socialising after his program. He had his house at the end of the Woolloomooloo Pier in Sydney. He would head off to lunch at his favourite restaurants on the Woolloomooloo Pier every day. He would have his ice bucket full of chilled white wine, and various people would turn up there, from everybody from premiers to police commissioners to his work colleagues. So they were great times, the 80s. And another personality, someone like our very own Darren Hinch, of course, who at 3AW was gigantic through the 1980s and before he went to television. Darren would hold court at all sorts of, Chinese restaurants and pubs around Melbourne, and people likewise would come and spend time eating and drinking and talking with Darren. Those things don't happen anymore, because I think work life is a lot more intense, and people expect you to be at work and not in a pub eating and drinking all afternoon. It's probably, I think it's nice to have those memories, and I think working people of a younger generation probably don't understand what that was like back then. But times change. Everything changes. We all move on. We're all a lot healthier these days. I think all of us eat more sensibly and drink probably a lot less than what we used to back then. But boy, we had some fun.
This is Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals. Celebrating lives in these challenging times, Tobin Brothers offer a range of very practical solutions to help you plan a funeral and pay tribute to your loved one. For more information, visit tobinbrothers.com.au. And more with Steve Price in just a moment.
You're listening to Great Australian Lives with Laura Turner for Tobin Brothers Funerals. Celebrating lives.
Welcome back to Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals Celebrating Lives. Our guest tonight is broadcaster and journalist Steve Price. I want to have a little listen now to a surprise, I guess for some people would have been a surprise appearance on not on radio, but on television. Let's have a listen.
It is a goat stomach, kidney and liver in a maggot rice roll, topped with flies, fly pupae, and raw liver. Soil sauce, which is century egg and fish juice, and pickled cringer, which is boiled cow skin soaked in offal juice.
Good.
Taste the flies, Steve.
Yeah, they're great.
Oh, there's
Add a bit of crunch. Done. All done?
This is obviously you on I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here. Now, as I mentioned in the intro then, this was a surprise to some people that we'd see you on reality TV.
Yeah, it was a surprise to myself. I mean, they approached me a couple of times and I kept saying, look, I don't think I can do it. I've got a full-time job. A lot of the people who ended up going and doing that program were out of work at the time or had a career that wasn't full-on 5 days a week. I was doing at the time a national nighttime radio program on 3AW and on 2GB and 4BC and about 60 other stations around the country. I went to the chairman of the company at the time, Russell Tate, and I said, listen, I can understand why you might say no to this, but they've asked me if I would go and be one of the contestants in I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here in the African Jungle. Russell looked at me and said, you must be mad. Yes, you can do it if you like. It'll probably be pretty good for your profile and it'll be okay as a publicity stunt for the network. How long will you be gone? And I said, I think I'll probably 10 days. Russell at the tops be maybe 2 weeks. 43 days later, I'm still stuck in the jungle with all of these people, not being voted out early on as I thought I would be, and being forced to eat disgusting food and do things that I never thought I'd ever possibly do, including a very famous bungee jump from an extraordinarily high height into an African waterfall, which had me totally petrified. And my family sitting at home, my children said, no way he'll do it. And I stood there on top of that gantry and paused for 1 second and then fell face first into the waterfall, which was terrifying. The food challenges themselves, I early on worked it out. I mean, it's a very much a mental thing. So I convinced myself mentally that these people are not going to kill you because you're part of the show and they don't want you to die. And they also are not going to poison you because if they do, it's going to look bad if you die on national television. So what I would do is when Julia Morris described the food like that, I sort of went la, 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 la. So I couldn't hear what she was saying. And I definitely, Laura, this is the big key for anyone who goes, if you end up on that show, my big tip, don't smell what they're serving you. Just suspend your sense of smell, chuck it in your mouth, chomp on it if you have to, swallow it quickly and make out it never happened.
The smell of things is enough to put me off eating anything slightly questionable. So I don't know how you did it. And bungee jumping is something I've always said I would just never do. You just couldn't pay me enough to do it. So you're well ahead of me in the management of your senses, that is for sure. While in the jungle, in the African jungle, end up forgetting that the cameras were there? Do you get so sort of entrenched in the bubble that you just forget, or are you aware all the time you're being watched?
No, you forget most of the time, and you're also mic'd up full time with a sort of a necklace around your neck, which is a hidden radio microphone. So it's not just what you do visually, but what you say is recorded constantly, and the production around that show is quite a thing to behold, and there's a whole control room with people sitting there watching these cameras. So within that jungle, which is quite a small area, it's not that large in that camp, there are four fixed cameras with people in hidden away from, you can't see the actual camera or the cameraman, but you know they're there. And then there's other fixed cameras all over the place. We worked out there was one small spot where if you stood really still, you could probably be out of vision, but you were never out of them hearing on audio what you were up to. So you had to be careful. I mean, that included the shower where you had one cold shower for the whole camp where you had to go and shower. There was two cameras on that as well. I mean, so you had to protect your modesty and be very careful in what you were doing there. But after, I imagine, you know, a couple of days, it becomes survival. It's a mental thing and a physical thing. It's survival. And you forget the cameras were there. And it's a very interesting question you ask, because people often say, well, you know, how did you approach this program? How did you actually go in there? And, you know, what sort of image did you want to have come out? Now, I hadn't watched one episode of that show before I went in deliberately because I didn't want to have a preconceived idea of what you should or shouldn't do. And I think I've watched 5 minutes of it when I came back of replay only. I just went in there and decided I needed to be myself. And whether that was me crying about potentially missing one of my daughters leaving Australia and going overseas for 2 months because I was stuck in the jungle, or whether it was being emotional over a whole bunch of other things, you just have to then be honest to yourself and honest to the rest of the people around you. And I've been, it's now, I think, 3-4 years since I did that. I still have people come up. And interestingly, because I used to fly weekly between Sydney and Melbourne to do the project and back for radio, I would have young fathers come up to me and say, can we take a selfie? And I go, why? Oh, my 10-year-old son and my 11-year-old daughter watched you in the jungle and thought you were fantastic, and they'll be very excited if they could see a picture of their dad with you. I didn't realise I was having that sort of impact on people. I still don't quite understand it, but apparently kids of a certain age were seeing their own father in what I was doing in there, and they followed me and appreciated what I was doing. I'm still very, very chuffed about what that did post the jungle to my own mental state, how I came out of it a much better person, I think. I came out of it a much better person physically, and I think my profile and character is seen around the country in a very different light.
Yeah, you have spoken openly about how you came out of I'm a celebrity, get me out of here, out of the African jungle, changed physically, you've just mentioned. What parts of your personality do you think changed, and has it remained that way in the time since?
Well, the second part of the question is easy to answer. Probably not completely. I think I came out initially as much more tolerant of other people's viewpoints, other people's character flaws, other people's habits than I had been when I went in. I certainly know from a practical point of view, as someone who gets quite annoyed on the roads when people drive stupidly, because most people don't know how to drive properly, I used to be not road ragey, but I would be vocal in my action toward other motorists, saying, you know, get out of the way, mate, you're a D-head. But when I came out of there, I was much more relaxed, much more easygoing, I think, and to the point where some people have said to me, well, you know, you have to be careful, you don't want to lose your hard edge. I said, look, I've come out a changed person. You can't go for 7 weeks, what was it, six and a half weeks in basically what is a detox concentration camp and not come out of it as a slightly different person. And I did come out of it, as I said, fitter and much more tolerant of other people. And I hope a lot of that has stayed. And I do often have to check myself and go, you know, go back to what you were like post the jungle and just relax a little bit more. And having not worked on a full-time basis for the last 6 months, I think that's allowed me to sort of slip back to my post-jungle persona. I'm much more relaxed these days.
Well, that's good to hear. This is Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. In these challenging times, Tobin Brothers offer a range of very practical solutions to help you plan a funeral and pay tribute to your loved one. For more information, visit tobinbrothers.com.au and more with Steve Price in just a moment.
You're listening to Great Australian Lives with Laura Turner for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
Welcome back to Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. Tobin Brothers now offer fully live-streamed services so that anyone who cannot attend the funeral of a loved one can still view the service and participate. For more information, visit tobinbrothers.com.au. And we've had plenty of information tonight with Steve Price, broadcaster, iconic one at that, and journalist, of course. Now, we've talked all about your career, those rough and ready days in the 80s. Steve grew up in South Australia, your time in the African jungle, that surprise appearance on reality TV, how it's changed you. But I want to know about your family. You've got two daughters who you're very proud of and often voice their opinions to you. One, you said, has graduated from university or is studying law. Is that something that you encouraged her to do? Is that something you ever wanted to do?
She's 23. I don't think you encourage 23-year-olds to do anything. You just give them the ability to get there if they want to, and she's done that. Both of my children are have inherited from their father a love of travel, which is international travel, which is great. And they were lucky enough that I took them on lots of trips overseas, and so they've decided now, and I'm very proud to say, fund their own travels and work overseas. My second daughter, Kate, has managed to live for 8 to 10 months in London, working full-time and enjoying seeing that part of Europe. She then went back and spent time living in Berlin with a boyfriend and managed to work there as well. She's now back. My older daughter, as you said, she's just sadly had to come back from Belgium in Brussels in Belgium because of COVID. She was due to be there for 6-7 months doing a final year of her law degree on placement to a law school in Belgium, and COVID hit, so she was immediately evacuated out there. She got back to Australia half an hour before the borders got shut down, so we were lucky to get her back. So they're both independent young women. They keep me on my toes. They have very strong attitudes to everything from politics to sport and the arts, and so they keep their old man as modern as can be possible. But raising your children is a full-time job. It's tough, but it's so rewarding when you see them come out the other side, and they will make their own way in their own lives. They're both very talented young women, and I'm so proud of them. They're fantastic.
It is a very challenging job, and I'm sure it's one you're doing very well. And Steve, lastly, what's next for you? What's on the agenda for Steve Price in 2020?
Playing lots more golf, which is I've come to late because I've never had much time to do it when I was working full time. So I'm very much enjoying playing much more golf. I'm into the, as I mentioned to you, podcast. The podcast pool is very crowded, but it's most rewarding. I've launched just recently a new podcast called On the Record, which is interviews with some of the big names in Australian media and entertainment. Now, as I said, I've talked to Sam Newman and Kerri-Ann Kennelly. Also spoken with Hedley Thomas, who did that extraordinary podcast, The Teacher's Pet. Hedley's one of the best investigative journalists in the country. Rita Panahi is a columnist, of course, in the Herald Sun, regular appearances on the Nine Network and on Sky News. So I'll continue to roll those out. I'm also doing a travel podcast with Sonia Poloska, who was with Luxury Escape. So all of that's happening. And who knows, back on full-time radio at some stage in the future. But I'm enjoying what I am describing. And this might be a new trend, Laura. Maybe we can explore whether this is a new trend. It's the mature age gap year, which I would completely endorse for anyone listening to us. If you have the opportunity like me to have a mature age gap year, grab it with both hands.
I am not of your age, Steve, but I can completely appreciate that. I'm sure that that would be something a lot of people would agree with. Thank you very much for being on the show tonight. It has been an absolute pleasure to look back at your life and career and forward as well. Thank you, Steve.
Been a great privilege. Thank you, Laura.
If you've enjoyed our chat with Steve Price tonight and you'd like to share it with a friend, subscribe to the podcast. This is Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. And in these challenging times, Tobin Brothers offer a range of very practical solutions to help you plan a funeral and pay tribute to your loved one. For more information, visit tobinbrothers.com.au. And of course, join us the same time next week when we celebrate another great Australian life.
You're listening to Great Australian Lives with Laura Turner for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.